A small group of out-of-state companies have been buying up mobile home lots in Illinois and raising the rents. Now, some communities are pushing for rent control. Here's Urbana resident Terry Baker.
They got me by the butt, to be honest with you. On a fixed income of $1,000 a month, where are you going to go?
Plus, there will be only one total lunar eclipse this year. It's happening on Sunday, even though it's very cold. Why should you go outside to see it? Here's astronomer David Leake.
Well, to me, it's really just nature. It's like, why go look at the Grand Canyon? It's a beautiful thing that happens. You're actually seeing the Earth's shadow.
But first, social service agencies have had a difficult few years, especially after the budget crisis. We'll hear about what they're hoping to see from the Pritzker administration. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, residents in some Illinois mobile home parks say their rent has gotten too high because out-of-state businessmen are buying up land and raising rents. We'll look into that issue. Plus, there's a lunar eclipse coming up this Sunday night. It'll be your best chance to see one in a few years. We'll be talking about that. But first, Governor Pritzker campaigned in part on making Illinois' economy fairer for everyone. And in his inaugural address on Monday, he said he wants to strengthen wages and services for working families.
We contend every day with an economy that gives too little and takes too much, that allows passion and work ethic to be overwhelmed by student loans, unexpected health emergencies, and the rising cost of living. We want strong families, but we have yet to embrace more robust policies supporting paid parental leave and affordable child care that will sustain them.
Over this week and next, we'll be speaking with different groups to hear what they want out of the Pritzker administration. Today, we're starting with social service agencies, including those that work with children and families. Many agencies in the social service sector took a beating during former Governor Bruce Rauner's term. As you may know, our state government went without a budget for more than two full years. So what are they hoping to see from our new governor during these next four? We're going to be speaking to a few of them now. Children's Home and Aid works in 60 counties across Illinois. Last year, they helped about 40,000 children and families. Nancy Ronquillo is its president and CEO. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello, Nyla. I'm delighted to be here.
Also with us is Sarah House. She's CEO of the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. They represent 60 providers across Illinois. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, good morning, Nyla.
So I wanted to ask both of you about what it's like to serve on transition teams. I think it's one of the things we hear a lot about when a new administration comes in, but I think most people don't know what it means. Nancy and Sarah, both of you have been doing this. Nancy, let's start with you. When you're helping a governor transition, what do you all do?
Well, the exciting opportunity that I had to serve as co-chair of the Health and Human Services Committee was a chance to really look at the big challenges and the big opportunities, and to do that with some of the most diverse, experienced, insightful, and savvy leaders from across Illinois and from all corners of Illinois and community. For example, we had faith-based leaders and practitioners, folks who understand and work every day on the front line with individuals who've struggled with homelessness or access to better employment opportunities or health problems that have threatened their ability to both work and contribute and raise their families. And it was really amazing to have such a diverse set of individuals at the table to look at the complex but also interrelated problems that communities across Illinois face.
Sarah, you were also on the same committee. Is this an opportunity for you also to help shape priorities, or what you would like to have help shape priorities for the next 4 years?
Oh, absolutely, Nyla. I think the one thing I would add to what Nancy said is this is that opportunity. We've all had those moments where we have said, boy, if I were in charge or if I had my way, I would do it this way. I would do it differently. Well, here was really that opportunity for all of us to come together. And that was the question. If you were here, if you were in charge, how would you do it? Why would you do it? What is the impact it will have? Not just because that sounds good, but let's talk about what is the impact? What will that do for Illinois? How will it make us move forward? But it gave us that opportunity to really dream big, and the sky's the limit. What do we want out of this state? How do we want to help our citizens, and how can we get there?
I want to hear your answers to both of those questions in just a minute. But first, Nancy, can you tell us a little bit more about Children's Home and Aid? You all offer a wide range of services all across Illinois, correct?
That is correct. We have been serving Illinois since 1883, and we've been serving Illinois, as you mentioned earlier, across communities, rural communities, suburban communities, inner city, from the top of the state to Wisconsin, all the way down to the very southernmost tip. In three big areas, we've always worked with very fragile families and children who needed loving homes for whatever reason. So we have a very important and deep commitment to children who come to the attention of and rely on the child welfare system, foster care, and intact family services. We have a very significant commitment to children's early learning. So we are providing early childhood services, again, across Illinois. And then a very diverse set of services where in community the greatest challenges are facing kids and families. It could be in helping runaway youth or homeless youth, youth and families who are struggling with communities beset by violence and poverty. And so our mission calls us to help any child, any youth, any family who is striving for a better life and really needing some support and some strengthening to achieve those dreams of theirs.
And Sarah, as CEO of the Illinois Behavioral Health Association, you represent behavioral health providers across the state. Can you remind us a little bit more about where they are and what they do, these providers?
Sure. So our providers are mental health and substance abuse providers that are in communities, and they often provide mental health treatment, substance use treatment. Many of them do wellness and prevention services, and they're in every corner of the state. So we have Chicago, Rockford, all the way down to Metropolis, and really every community in between. They are the lifeblood of the behavioral health system across the state. And even though over the past 4 years they have shrunk, unfortunately, there are many that are still around and available and eager to serve people who are in need of mental health and substance use services.
Sarah, I wonder if we could talk about the last 4 years. Before I do that, though, can I ask you quickly, has the federal government a shutdown affected your providers yet?
It has not for ours. The portion of the budget that impacted mental health and substance use was already passed and signed before the shutdown occurred. So we are in a little more fortunate position than many others right now.
And I wonder how, though, you would characterize the past 4 years and how that, what the state of your behavioral health providers are, given the past 4 years of the previous administration in Illinois and the fiscal crisis. How would you characterize things?
The past 4 years were very demoralizing, I would say, for our providers, very destabilizing, chaotic would be another term that I would use. I think there were moments where we had some great accomplishments, like passage of parity legislation that really enforced some of the strongest parity laws in the nation. So we've had some good things for sure, but overall, when you go back to a budget stalemate of, I think, 736 days, I believe, certainly that creates some instability, and we lost providers. I mean, there's no other way to say it. There are communities today that do not have life-saving behavioral health services because of the last 4 years, and that we won't dig out overnight. We are very excited and eager to work with the Pritzker administration, and even he himself acknowledged in his speech on Monday that it will take time. You don't just turn the lights back on, and we know that as well, but our providers are very hopeful that the changes that are coming will be very positive.
Nancy, I know you've been president of Children's Home and Aid since 2001. I imagine that gives you quite a perspective on funding for social service agencies, and I wonder, with that perspective, how the past 4 years compared for your organization.
Well, we had the struggles that Sarah so well described, and we had to terminate programs, end programs, lay off staff, stop serving kids and families who were in crisis, who had extraordinary needs and were struggling. So the need didn't go away, just the resource did. And so that was very, very difficult to manage through the notion of, you know, a chaotic time and not being able to predict whether we could open up those services again, whether staff, if they found a part-time job to kind of be able to pay their bills in the meantime, they could come back. And so I like to say, you know, human services, it's not a pop-up store. It's not something you can just shut down and open up and you've got skilled, competent, trained individuals who have the stature and integrity and relationship in community and with people. It's not just a, you know, a one-time transaction. These are important relationship-based services that if you really want the best outcome, you aren't start stopping them in such a, you know, unpredictable way. I also wanted to just point out that the federal shutdown is having an impact on many families for whom, you know, the federal government has been their source of income and employment. And when families are thrown into an unpredictable financial situation, can we make our car note? Can we pay the mortgage or my rent this month? That kind of stress puts more pressure on families, and it's that kind of stress that can lead to, you know, going to buy a six-pack on my way out to whatever because I really don't know how else to cope, or I don't know how I'm going to pay my child care provider, so can I, how can I cope with this new pressure? And it's those stressors that also we become the safety net. The human services fabric is so essential at a time when families are facing that kind of stress.
And that said, Nancy, I wonder what hopes you have for the next 4 years. Sarah, I'd love for you to weigh in after this as well. What are your goals? What would you love to see happen over the next 4 years with this Pritzker administration?
I'd say three things. One, and he's called for it, a reinvestment in the human services infrastructure or fabric. It's so critical. If we want better academic outcomes, we want more success in schools and healthier communities and a healthier economy, you must invest in the human services infrastructure. We are your lever for change there. Secondly, I would say particular to the foster care system, there is new federal legislation. There's a new opportunity to invest in prevention and family strengthening. Let's maximize that opportunity and be sure that every child has a safe and loving home. I think we can really make significant gains there. And third, I would say that a focus on Illinois' youth in a robust way. We've really done great, great work in the early childhood arena, but kids don't disappear when they turn 6 or 7 or 8 or become teenagers. Let's invest in our youth, positive youth development, start to finish. Let's make sure all our kids get launched well in life. And I'm very hopeful about those as opportunities right now.
Sarah, what about you? Top three priorities? We often hear every lawmaker talking about the opioid crisis and what they'd like to do. What do you want to see Governor Pritzker? What do you want to see state lawmakers in Springfield do?
Absolutely. I think the opioid crisis is a great starting point that we know every community in this state has been dealing with the opioid crisis. As Governor Pritzker said on Monday, we've also seen increases in suicide. Over the past 16 years, we've gone up 23% in suicides in this state, and we have a workforce shortage at the same time. I mean, 85 of our 102 counties are designated as health professional shortage areas for mental health services. So we've got a lot of work to do. What are our three priorities? I think the first thing has to be stability. If I could say anything stronger, it would be we need stability in the system. And many of the areas that Nancy mentioned will help us stabilize that system. investing in human services and particularly behavioral health will include that. I often say budgets are a reflection of priorities. And thus far, we have heard mental health and substance abuse are a priority of this administration. We believe going forward that will continue, and we will want to see that in the budget, particularly in the first budget address that we see from Governor Pritzker. And I think finally, probably one of the most important things that we did not see the last 4 years is communication and collaboration with your community providers and with the human service system. It's critical to bring us to the table. We want to be partners. We want to be heard. We want to hear what the administration has to say, and we want to work together so that more people in more communities can get those services that they need. So that really strong collaborative bond between the administration and the providers is really critical for us.
Nancy, do you think people understand what Sarah's saying about that collaborative bond? I think people tend to think, well, the government does what the government does, and social service agencies do what they do. What's the relationship between them?
I think that's such an important insight. I think that the folks in the community don't understand that it is this, we are the front line. This is where a need is met through community-based organizations and community residents that the state generally is contracting for most of those human services. A great example is foster care. So 85% of the nearly 16,000 boys and girls who are in foster care right now are in the care of organizations across Illinois, in Champaign, Rockford, Chicago, East St. Louis. Community-based organizations are providing the casework care, the supervision of the families, the support to the families, and that is it is critical to have the voice. And the governor and lieutenant governor called and underscored their commitment to a full engagement of community, their voice, the insights, and the participation in a kind of a full stature.
Yeah, it sounds like that. So I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Nancy Ronquillo for being with us, Sarah Howe as well. Ladies, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You can count on a couple things, especially here in Illinois cold winters. Today is no exception. The cost of living will go up, especially rent, considering we're not a rent-controlled state. Many community advocates have been trying to change that. One place you might not consider where this matters is manufactured homeowners. Upset with the rising cost of lots their homes are on, they're joining in on the fight for rent control. The owners of these mobile home lots, sometimes dubbed as mobile home moguls, are free to jack up the price of rent, according to their tenants. And this would cost them thousands to move to another park. This is an aspect of affordable housing we don't hear a lot about, the mobile home sector. And Anna Casey has been reporting on this and what this looks like in Champaign-Urbana for WILL. She's in studio with me here in Urbana now. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Doug Ryan, the Senior Director of Affordable Home Ownership for the nonprofit Prosperity Now. Hi, Doug. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So, Anna, maybe we should just start with understanding a little bit about how it works in a mobile home park. Who owns what when you are a mobile homeowner?
Right. So residents own their home, but they lease the land that it sits on. So in some ways, it's like owning any other type of home. They make repairs on the home. They pay for upgrades, but they lease the most valuable asset of the home, which is the land. And it's become more popular for investors to buy up these mobile home parks and make money by renting out the land.
And so for your story, you spoke with residents of one mobile home park in Champaign County, Wilson's. Mm-hmm. There's just pretty small. There's just about a dozen homes in the community. How much have rents increased just in this one place?
Right. So rents have gone up to almost $300 a month, whereas they were about $236 a month, including utilities, just a few years ago. So for these residents, they say that's a very significant increase. And for new residents, people just moving into the park, that's even higher. That's above $300. So for some residents that I talked to who have been living there for decades, Their rent has pretty much doubled.
Wow. And so $300 a month for some people might not sound like a lot of when you're thinking about a rent, but then you're saying this is double what some people have paid, which seems like a huge increase. And even just an increase of, I know one person you spoke with, Terry Baker, her rent went from $236 a month to nearly $300 a month. That's like almost a 30% increase in rent. I wanted to just play a little bit of audio. I know, Anna, you spoke with one of the residents, Terry Baker, and she was explaining how this affected her budget. Here's Terry Baker.
And if I wanted to move this place, it's going to cost me $5,000 to $7,000 to move it and set it back up. Okay, and they own almost every park around here. They got me by the butt, to be honest with you. On a fixed income of $1,000 a month, where are you going to go?
So that's really, I think, a good explanation. That's Terry Baker speaking to WILL reporter Anna Casey, who's in studio with me now. Anna, so for someone who's on a fixed income like Terry, it sounds like it's too expensive for her to move. She needs to stay where she's at. What would happen if her rent continued to go up?
Right. So a lot of the residents who I spoke with said that they would eat less. They might go without a medication. So, you know, while it may not seem like a very significant increase, these residents who, you know, many of them are retired, they say that even that small change of $10 or $20 can really impact their budget. So for them, they could really go without certain necessities.
Certainly, yes. I mean, horrible to think of someone thinking they can't afford food or Medicare or medical care. Doug, how common, Doug Ryan is with us from Prosperity Now in D.C. Is the story of what we're hearing with this one mobile home park in Champaign County, are we starting to hear this across the country? Is this a common story?
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. It's becoming more common. I mean, traditionally, manufactured housing communities or mobile home parks had been owned by local owners, people who had connections or to the community and to the residents that live there. They may own one or two or three or five communities in a, you know, in a region. But now you're seeing more investment money outside of the of states or outside of the regions coming in, you know, from hedge fund money to real estate investment trusts, which act like a mutual fund for real estate. And things like that, investing in manufactured housing community owners or buying parks outright. And so it is absolutely becoming more common. Absolutely.
And Doug, when we're thinking about mobile home communities, what's the median income of a typical mobile home owner in the U.S.?
It's about $29,000, $30,000. So compare that to the typical homeowner across the country, which is about $70,000. It's considerably less than a typical homeowner. So you have a lot less flexibility if your costs go up.
Mm-hmm. And so to Doug's point about this happening across the country, Anna, about this with this particular mobile home park, what do we know about who owns them?
Right. So it's a bit complicated. But what we do know from property records is that an investor, David Reynolds, bought this park a few years ago, and he also bought about a dozen other parks in the county. Again, that's just the county. So he's based in Colorado. He's with a company called RV Horizons, and they own mobile home parks in dozens of states. Including those parks here.
And if it's confusing to you, I imagine it took you and I talked about this before we went on air, the amount of reporting you did to just even figure out who owns this. Do the residents know who they're paying their rent to and who owns the park?
Right. So the residents are a bit frustrated because they say there's not a lot of accountability. Sometimes people aren't in the management office, or they'll get a notification that the management company has changed, but it'll say, you know, continue making your check out to RV Horizons. So they're, unlike with the local owners, they're not really sure who owns their park now, or who they should call, you know, for things like emergency maintenance. So for them, they feel like the owners are kind of hiding.
Hmm. And so you mentioned David Reynolds, one of the owners. He and his business partner, Frank Rolfe, they did not respond to requests for your comment for
right.
your story. So we should point that out. But we do have some audio from them. They're co-founders of an organization called Mobile Home University. And so Mobile Home University has a boot camp, which is like a three-day seminar, which costs $2,000 to attend. And it teaches attendees the financial practices of what it is to buy and get a return on your investment in mobile homes. Let's hear a little bit of that audio.
Family parks tend to have higher expenses. You have more people in the households. They use more water. They wash cars, whatever. But the big thing is they can really tolerate rent increases really well. So the family parks are our favorite park. Almost all of the parks we have, with rare exceptions, are all family parks. And it pretty much works throughout America because there's so much need for affordable housing right now. It didn't work at all back in the 50s and 60s. There were no poor people. So basically, you couldn't make it work. Today, there's a huge number of poor people, and there's more poor people like every day.
That audio is of mobile home mogul Frank Rolfe. That's from The Guardian, actually. Doug, when we're listening to that and we're hearing him talk about how these families can tolerate rent increases, how this is a part, I wonder how this fits into the whole problem we hear often of the lack of affordable housing across the country.
Right.
Doug, I'm sorry. We're having a really hard time hearing you. We're going to try to reconnect with you there. Anna, can I just ask you about when we're thinking about these kind of folks? So are we seeing this? We're seeing this in this particular company. What do you know from your reporting of them in terms of how many big corporations like this now own mobile home parks throughout Illinois and the country?
Right. So this company isn't even the largest. The largest is actually Sun Communities, which is based in Michigan. They own tens of thousands of lots around the country. So what we're seeing is kind of more consolidation into a handful, maybe five companies that are buying up these mobile home parks as an investment.
And so I wonder, we mentioned at the beginning of this, the way that there are people who are organizing to try to help these homeowners. That's members of an organization called Manufactured Housing Action. What are they doing? How are they getting involved with this?
Right. So they are advocating for rent control measures. As you mentioned, Illinois has a ban on rent control. So they are advocating for lifting that ban. And Illinois State Senator Maddie Hunter, who represents an area out of Chicago, she has actually introduced legislation that would lift that ban. And her office told me yesterday that this is an issue that they're interested in pursuing this next legislative session.
It's WILL reporter Anna Casey. We're talking about her reporting she's been doing on mobile home communities, particularly in the Champaign-Urbana area. But as we're hearing, this problem applies not just across the state, but the country. We'll tweet out Anna's story for those of you who would like to see more of it. Doug Ryan is also with us. He's the Senior Director of Affordable Home Ownership for Prosperity Now. He's on the line from D.C. Hey, Doug, so I wonder if we could get back to that question I was just asking you about where mobile homes fit into. We hear so much about the problem of affordable housing across the country. Where do mobile homes fit into that?
Right. They are the largest source of unsubsidized affordable housing in the country. So what that means is that they fit this niche, you know, for people who want to own their own home but can't afford a traditional site-built home or something like that. But more importantly, they are a piece of the housing continuum, you know, typically in rural or suburban areas, or sometimes in urban areas. But they are, you know, they're an option for people who don't want to live in a garden style or a low-rise apartment. That's typically the other option that some of these families have. But they offer people more privacy and more control of their environment. So they very much fit into it. But they're not being built anymore. There's just not new ones being developed. And we're also losing, you know, a number of them each and every year because of land use or redevelopment and things like that, and also poor state law.
And so because there aren't new ones being built, I wonder if we could go back to that audio that we were playing earlier for the two gentlemen in particular, the two business owners, their mobile home university. They were talking about how you could make a lot of money off of these parks. Is the fact that new ones aren't being built partially why people like these businesses are able to make a lot of money?
Absolutely. There's a couple reasons. That's one reason, is because there's no competition in many ways, and it's hard for families to relocate their home to another park because there aren't vacancies in those other parks. It's very hard to move those units and things like that. And so unlike other housing options, the family owns the home and they have an asset that they want to retain. So they have to spend thousands of dollars to move it if they're even permitted to move it or if it can be moved or give up that asset. And so community owners, the aggressive ones, have them over a barrel in many ways because they know they can push them as hard as they possibly can in order to extract as much rent from them as possible. And then the other reason why these communities are so profitable, and they are more profitable than any other residential sector that investors can consider. The other reason why they're so profitable is because you don't have to maintain the homes. If the toilet fails or the sink backs up, the community owner doesn't have to do anything about it. That's up to the homeowner. So they have a really low operational cost, and so they just have to maintain, you know, the infrastructure, the water, sewer, the road, the driveway, the roads, and things like that. And they often don't even do that, and that's another way to extract more cash out of these properties.
Doug, because this sort of seems like it's kind of an in-between in terms of it's not, for example, an apartment building where there are lots of regulations for how that needs to be maintained. It's not a owner-tenant situation in the terms of, like, you know, I think everybody who's ever rented an apartment in Chicago can tell you about tenant law and how strict it is in Chicago. Do mobile home parks, do they legally also kind of fall in an in-between space when it comes to regulation and rights?
They do, and it's very different across the country. But Illinois has, you know, pretty good law, but that's relative because the law is weak in most places. Illinois has some of the same protections that they offer, you know, apartment tenants, mobile home or manufactured home community residents have the same protections. For example, you have to have offer them a one-year lease, and the lease has to be renewable absent cause. And so that's a positive thing. Some states don't even have that. But one of the biggest weaknesses in Illinois law is that, as was suggested earlier by Anna, is that there's no notice when the community is up for sale. If the community is about to be closed, you have to get a 12-month notice, but that's only if it's going to be closed outright. But if it's being sold for the same purpose, the residents don't get notified, and so they don't have an opportunity to react. And we advocate for residents to purchase their communities with the assistance either of nonprofit groups or state or local government organizations, and that can ensure the security for the long term. And Illinois just doesn't have the tools in place to allow that to happen, unlike a few other states.
Anna, going back to this one place, I'm thinking of the resident you spoke with, Terry Baker. What are they doing? How are they working? It sounds like it's a smaller community, so I wonder if that makes a difference in terms of how they've mobilized.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they live in a very close-knit community, as you mentioned. It's maybe about a dozen homes there. But one of the things that they're doing to mobilize is they've joined with a group called Manufactured Housing Action, to advocate for lifting that ban on rent control. So that's really the fight that they seem to be focused on now because they are so immediately concerned about those rent increases.
That's actually how you found out about this story.
Right, right. So there was an Illinois Senate hearing in Urbana, and they held several hearings around the state related to this issue. And many of the people who attended that Senate hearing here in Urbana were mobile home park residents, people who owned mobile homes but were leasing the land.
And so that's how you heard about how much they were paying for rent. So It sounds like Senator Mattie Hunter is going to be reintroducing this legislation in terms of trying to lift the ban on rent control. Is it only for mobile home parks or is it lifting the ban on, I imagine it's just for that?
So it's actually for all types of renters. And so manufactured housing owners mobile home owners have kind of emerged as some unlikely advocates in this fight for lifting the ban on rent control. So it's really all types of renters, and it's something that mobile home owners feel that they may also benefit from.
Anna Casey, I know you'll keep an eye on this and will let us know how this story unfolds over the year, but I want to thank you and your reporting. Again, we'll tweet that out. Doug Ryan is also the Senior Director of Affordable Home Ownership for Prosperity Now. Doug, thanks for being with us as well. Anna, thanks for being here too.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For the environmentally conscious homeowner, there are all kinds of ways to retrofit your living space. We've talked on this show about houses that keep heat in and save electricity. There are, of course, others who put solar panels on their homes. But what about light pollution? Last month, we learned about the state's first dark sky park, and we addressed an idea that's central to folks who care about the night sky, that it's a natural resource that should be preserved. And by the way, that natural resource will come in handy soon. There's going to be a lunar eclipse late this Sunday evening. If you're interested, though, in doing your own part to lessen light pollution with your house, John Hasselbring has some advice from you. He's an architect by training and is now the Director of Planning and Operations with Champaign County Forest Preserve. He's in studio with me here in Urbana. Hi, John. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
So you're an architect, and you also coordinated the lighting for part of the Forest Preserve that's now part of Illinois' first dark sky park. Before we get to how this might work in someone's house and how they might do it, I wonder what this looks like in the Forest Preserve. What does it mean to light the Forest Preserve in a responsible way to preserve the darkness of the night sky?
Absolutely. First of all, we want to minimize the amount of light that we're using. We're a conservation district, and that's our primary focus. We want to restore and conserve natural areas as best we can because they provide habitat for wildlife. So if we can, first of all, minimize the amount of light that we're using and really focus on the user areas, that's our first goal. So primary goal to minimize. And then when we do need to light, we have different trailheads, parking lots for rental facilities. And so we want to try to provide light for our users there so that they have a safe approach into the buildings and then back to their cars after the event. So trying to focus that light to the proper areas.
And when you focus that, that's in a literal sense, the way that the light is being positioned in directions.
Absolutely. Full cutoff fixtures are what we focus on. Full cutoff, if you can picture the shape of a bell and the hammer inside the bell as being the light bulb, all the light that you want will be directed towards the ground where you need it to light the surface so that you can see. It will, as opposed to possibly a globe fixture or a lantern that might emit light in all directions that can cause a glare, make visibility worse. This type of fixture, full cutoff, will direct it where you want it.
Mm-hmm. So that's how you guys are doing it in the Forest Preserve on the grounds. I wonder what about homes and buildings? And I'm thinking about this. I was gone over the holidays for a little bit, and when I came back, there was a huge light that suddenly appeared in my alley, which I'm sure is people in the alley are happy there's a light, but it's so bright that it actually lights up an entire room in my house overnight now.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is very unfortunate. Yes.
Yeah, floodlight. So there are responsible ways to light up residences and other areas around alleys and such. Really a similar type fixture. They're made, these full cutoff fixtures are made for residential applications too. If you think about the post top lights that are usually lanterns out in people's front yards that are kind of light up the whole yard, there's wall-mounted fixtures. You put next to an entrance door to a home or to garage doors. Those are also areas where you can install a full cutoff fixture, light up the ground, improve your visibility coming into and off of your property, and help to preserve the night sky.
And so I wonder how expensive this ends up being. I think that's probably the one thing a lot of people who are listening are wondering.
Right.
I wonder if we can start just with Champaign County and with the Forest Preserve. How did you all handle the costs of all of this? If I recall correctly, this was about $30,000 worth of lighting work that you all did within the Forest Preserve.
It was. And we had a lot of infrastructure involved in that. A larger site, so we're using larger scaled fixtures that are designed for roadway parking lot applications. So when you get into all of the logistics of the conduit and the concrete to mount a post to put the light on, the wiring and all of the other costs that we incurred, it can start to add up. And for sure, the same thing could happen for a residential application. But there are some fixtures that are available at places like local hardware stores where you can go and purchase a fixture and possibly swap it out or maybe hire an electrician if you're not electrically minded, to replace that yourself.
I'm speaking with John Hasselbring. He's the Director of Planning and Operations for Champaign County Forest Preserve. We're talking about dark skies and dark sky parks and dark sky initiatives. Someone who also has a really vested interest in this is David Leek. He's the professor of astronomy and physics at Parkland College. He's director of the Starkle Planetarium, and he's with us also in our studios in Urbana. Hey, David, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you very much for having me.
What is it important for people to be, I mean, there's one thing for us to be thinking about dark skies and our parks and our public properties. Why do you think it's important for us to be thinking about this in residential areas and for our private homes or for businesses even?
It's a fantastic question, because when I talk about these things, I'm sure there are some out there that think, well, this guy just wants us to turn our lights off so we can see the night sky. And actually,
and then people worry about crime,
exactly,
and all of those sorts,
exactly,
of things.
But if you really look into it, it's some of the statistics are amazing. John was talking about the costs. I don't have the figures in front of me, but not long ago, the entire city of Calgary replaced all their streetlights with full cutoff fixtures. Well, I show in my class that if you use a full cutoff fixture, you can get the same lighting on the ground with a lower wattage bulb, and now you're saving money. And the Calgary lights paid for themselves after about 7 or 8 years. So you're actually saving some money.
So it's actually more energy efficient? John,
yeah,
you're nodding your
absolutely.
Head as well. Okay.
Yeah, energy efficient. And again, you just use a lower wattage bulb. As you mentioned about the crime, there was an alley in Chicago that there was a lot of crime. So they lit up the alley, and the crime actually went up because people could see what they were doing. So light is not always the answer. It's in... You have to have the right light. I know some people think you just should put up a light, but and one of the examples I use in class is if in the house I used to live in, no longer, but if I turned on my porch light, which a lot of people do, it created a shadow in front of a window, my son's bedroom window. So if someone was driving by my house, they could be standing right next to my son's window. You'd never see them because your attention is drawn to the light. So it's not just putting up a light, but putting up the right light, directed in the right way to light up what you want. Because it's amazing the kind of shadows that you can create with bright lights. And that's where criminals hide.
And I wonder how you think people can start to go about thinking about this with their house. If they're thinking about replacing lighting, or if as people are thinking about making their homes more energy efficient, where do you think are the best places for people to start with this? John?
Sure. I think LEDs, LED lights are primarily going to be lower wattage. They're going to cost maybe a little bit more up front, but you're going to save a lot more money over the life of that bulb, and it's going to last a lot longer than a fluorescent or incandescent bulb. Looking at the color temperature of a bulb is going to be also important. Color temperature is really how it's described as in Kelvin. 2700 to 3500 is going to be a warmer light. 6000 is going to mimic daylight, and that's
okay.
Probably going to be.
I think a lot of. I've never really understood that, so thank you for explaining.
Yeah, that's going to be the more annoying light that is going to bother you when you're trying to relax at home at night.
And when we're there, are we talking about indoor lights, outdoor lights, both?
I think both. For sure.
And when we're thinking about an outdoor light, I think we tend to think, oh, we need to go for the highest wattage possible. What should we really be thinking about when we're thinking about outdoor lights and wattage and what's sufficient to light something?
Yeah. And I don't think, and this is just my opinion, it's not the brightness, it's the location. What I would encourage people to do is just to walk outside their home at night and instead of just looking, actually evaluate what they're seeing. Am I creating shadows where people can hide? Am I lighting up the places I want to light? One of the things I stress to my classes is you should never actually see the light bulb. As John mentioned, it's full cutoff. So you should be able, your attention should be drawn to what you are trying to light and not the light itself.
And as we're thinking about all of that and light pollution, there's actually a lunar eclipse coming
yes.
this Sunday. And that's
yes.
the other reason why we asked you to come back and talk about this. We had, of course, it was funny. I was cleaning out a closet this weekend and I found my eclipse sunglasses from 2017.
Mm.
Clearly, I hadn't been in that closet for a while. But this is obviously different. Can you remind us the difference between a solar and a lunar eclipse?
Yeah, it just depends on what's being blocked out. As the moon goes around our Earth, sometimes it comes between the sun and the earth, and that's what we had back in 2017, was a solar eclipse. So the moon was blocking out the sun. And those, you got to be careful, because you're really looking in the same direction as the sun. So you need those glasses. So hang on to them for 2024. But this is a lunar eclipse that's happening Sunday night. So what's happening is the moon, full moon, is going into the Earth's shadow. And it's just like looking at a full moon. So very, very safe to watch.
And how often do we have these?
Well, you can have a couple of them a year, but it all kind of depends on the geometry, plus the fact we might have an eclipse, but we might be on the wrong side of the Earth. You got to be on the nighttime side of the Earth. So this is really the last one we're going to have for a little while. There are a couple coming up in 2021, 2022, but one of those happens, like the eclipse starts right as the sun is coming up. This is really the best one we're going to have till about 2025.
And does it make a difference what part of the state you're in? So we have thinking about folks who are listening on the northern end of the state. Sometimes we hear from people who are listening from the Wisconsin border. And then, of course, we have people listening from the far southern portion of the state, too. Does that make a difference when it comes to the lunar eclipse?
Not really. The moon might be in a slightly different spot in the sky, but it's not going to be all that much. So, and everybody in North America should be able to see this.
And again, the weather's going to make a difference too, though, right?
Well, it does have to be clear. Obviously, we have to have clear skies.
And there is a pretty big storm I've been watching that's coming across this weekend, but I think that timing of that storm is more Saturday rather than Sunday.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I've tried to bribe some of the weather forecasters, you know, offer them a little money, see if they can change that forecast. I think we'll probably be okay with the clouds. There might be some broken clouds. What I'm a little worried about is we may be looking at negative temperatures.
Oh, wow. And so what's the best time to see this then?
Well, the Earth really has two shadows. One is lighter than the other. So technically, the eclipse starts a little after 8:30, but the lighter part of the shadow, most people don't notice. The main event starts a little after 9:33, when it's going to look like somebody's taking a bite out of the moon. And then the moon will be completely inside the Earth's shadow from about 10:41 for a little bit over an hour. And you really don't need any optical aid for this. You can just look outside if you have a southern-facing window, you can, as long as you can see the moon, you can check this out from a warm room. But binoculars or if you have a telescope, you can get it out and look at it, but just stay warm.
Now, for both of you, I wonder what you like about these events. David, obviously, this is your life's work to look at these things, but I wonder, as someone who takes the time to see this, what you like about lunar eclipses? What's different?
Well, to me, it's really just nature. It's like, why go look at the Grand Canyon? It's a beautiful thing that happens. You're actually seeing the Earth's shadow. And I know we may have some flat earthers out there, but you can actually see that the Earth's shadow is curved, so which was part of the evidence that the ancient Greeks used to show that the world was round. And then also the moon might turn a little reddish. You might have heard about the blood moon, which drives me crazy because has nothing to do with blood. The reason the moon turns maybe reddish is the same reason a sunset might turn red. You're scattering the blue light from the sun by our Earth's atmosphere. Some of the red bends through and hits the moon, so we might have a reddish moon. But depending on how much dust is in the atmosphere at the time, will affect how red the moon gets. So it's just nature. It's just a beautiful thing to watch.
That's David Leek, who's the director of the Starkel Planetarium and teaches astronomy and physics at Parkland College. And I want to thank John Hasselbring for being with us as well with Champaign County Forest Preserve. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be continuing our series of conversations about the Pritzker administration, talking about the economy and what folks, including the Illinois Manufacturers Association, are hoping will happen with new leadership in Springfield. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and that's an easy way to find past shows. You download it, you set your home station to wherever your local NPR station is. And if you search for The 21st to follow us, that's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available on iTunes, Android, wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for us on Facebook. That's a way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just visit our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.